Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today as we are here every day, Monday through Friday on Breadbox Media, dominating the airwaves of two or even three people who are listening to the show. I don't even know. talking about life, the universe, and everything from a Catholic perspective. And we're here today with Steve Gradana. Steve is normally on my show on Friday. But we're doing a little bit of a switch around today due to various scheduling things. And so we thought we would have Steve on the show today. And I wanted to take a little time. Normally in this space, what we do is we talk about what's going on in the world of the movies and so forth. Because Steve is a film critic. That's what he does. He writes for Crux. He writes for the National Catholic Register. You can see him in Catholic Digest. The man is everywhere. He even turns up on YouTube doing his Real Faith 60-second reviews of movies where viewers watch wondering if he can actually get the review in 60 seconds. And he usually succeeds. But I thought it might be a good idea today to just talk a little bit about how does one wind up becoming a film critic? Why would somebody do that? What does it take to be a film critic? You know, my dad's, the whole life of writing that I wound up doing was something that my dad, rest his soul, his attitude toward all of that kind of thing was sort of, well, it beats working. So I always, you know, I begin my day sort of sitting here thinking, am I actually doing anything, or am I just, you know, and then I think, no, this really is necessary. You know, this is stuff that needs to get done, and people need to hear this. But I think of that often, you know, in sort of any non-traditional job, and film critic is one of those non-traditional jobs. And so I thought it might be a little interesting for a while to just talk about what brought you to doing this, and how do you see your role and your work in the world?
Wow. That's a really good and interesting question. Well, it goes back in my life to my early love of film to start with. And I spent a lot of my misspent youth was indeed spent at the movie theater. I loved to go to the Cineplex, particularly during the summers when the big blockbusters were in theaters, and Star Wars and The Empire Strikes Back were seminal experiences in my youth. I vividly remember seeing Star Trek, the motion picture, and walking away thinking, what the heck was that? and Superman, the movie, and Superman 2, and oh my goodness, Raiders of the Lost Ark, you know, just changed my life.
Yeah, yeah.
And as I went on, I began to discover movies that were not just thrilling and exciting, but were something more than that. I remember seeing Witness in 1985 and walking away really scratching my head and thinking about some of the themes in that movie. And that was a movie that really that stuck with me in a way that some of the others hadn't. And
Peter Weir made that, right?
Yes, he did.
Okay.
Yeah.
Peter Weir makes great movies. I mean, he just always does. But anyway.
So, Chariots of Fire. My father took me to Chariots of Fire when it was in theaters. Was that 1981 or 82?
That's about right. Yeah.
Yeah. Whatever it was, I remember I was in junior high. So I was young for such an adult movie. But I found it interesting. I found it intriguing, and it really, it challenged me to think about things that I otherwise, you know, that wouldn't have thought about. So there was that. Mm-hmm. Movies were a big part of my life. They were part of the way in which I thought about the world, and I understood on some level that they were really important.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't have much theory as to why, but that was where I was. The other really big thing about me at that time was that I was raised in an evangelical Protestant house, so Christianity was huge. God mm-hmm. was huge. Jesus was huge. And mm-hmm. my father was a pastor. I grew up with originally going to a Dutch Reformed church in my youngest years, and my dad was the pastor, and he left the ministry while we were still young, and mm-hmm. we started going to an Episcopalian church, and so that was my first encounter with the worship of God in liturgy and sacrament, and mm-hmm. that opened up new vistas to me.
Okay.
And we also started going to an Assemblies of God church in the middle of the week on Wednesdays for youth group, because my mom felt that it was important for me to have a connection with other Christian youth in a more dynamic and compelling way than was happening in the Episcopalian church. So already I was beginning to have a real ecumenical Protestant experience.
Uh-huh.
So movies were one of the only tap roots that I had to the larger popular culture, though, particularly of my youth, because I didn't listen to secular music. This was in my world at that time, that was kind of off limits. And so all my peers at school were talking about U2 and other bands at the time. U2 was okay because we had heard that they were Christians and you know, they had done 40 and so forth. And there were, but you know, then of course there was a lot of other stuff, and there was all like the heavy metal was all satanic, and we were allowed to listen to Christian music. And so I loved Petra and Resurrection Band. And then later Michael Card and John Michael Talbot, who mm-hmm. I know was also very important to you and your mm-hmm. early exposure to Catholic culture and so forth.
Yeah. Yeah.
But movies were at that point for me an acceptable touchstone to popular culture, and so I absorbed them, and animation particularly was a special love of mine, and my parents were open-minded enough to send me to art school when I got into college.
Okay.
And I wanted to be a cartoonist, but I also loved film, and I took some film classes. I took film history and history of animation, and then after I graduated, I got married, and Susie and I became Catholic the year after that. We can maybe a little bit later in the show, we might want to talk more about that. But when we got to Philadelphia, Suzanne said to me, you know, you love the faith and you love teaching and you're good at it. Why don't you, see if you could get a degree, go to seminary, get a degree. Maybe you'll wind up as a teacher. So I went to St. Charles Borromeo and I got my first master's degree in religious studies.
Mm-hmm.
And then, a number of years later, circa 2000, still a lover of film, a great reader of film criticism. I really loved reading Roger Ebert and a number of my other favorite film critics at the time. This was at first in the days before the internet. Everything was paper, and so I read Roger Ebert in the paper that I delivered as a paper boy when I was a boy, and I had friends of mine who lived in other cities clip out the film critics that I loved that were in the other city papers and actually mail them to me. That's how much of a film critic nerd I was. I had my friend mailing me film critic columns from critics in other papers. And so in 2000, a mutual friend, Jimmy Akin, asked me, he said to me, you know about film and art, and you know about religion, and you've thought a lot about the two of them together. How'd you like to come on Catholic Answers Live and talk about movies and faith? And I thought, yeah, I'd like to do that. And
okay.
That was 16 years ago, and that's really how it began.
That's so cool. You know, I remember not long before he died, Roger Ebert mentioned something that you had written in one of his reviews somewhere. And I remember thinking, you know, wow, that's pretty cool. You know, it's sort of like getting a baseball signed by Babe Ruth when things like that happen, you know.
And, it was really cool. And it's actually even a little bit cooler than what you described, because, you know, Ebert, and he, this wasn't just me, he was very gracious to younger critics, and he went out of his way to help them in their careers. Mm-hmm. And he was really treating me as a peer. He first did that in 2000, and was it 2004 that The Passion of the Christ came out? When he quoted my essay on The Passion of the Christ and anti-Semitism, both in his review and also on the air with Gene Siskel.
Really?
Yeah, he did.
I didn't know he'd done that.
Yeah, and that was a huge thrill. But the biggest, well, we'll have to get back to that.
We'll talk about it when we return. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. And we will be back with Steve Radonis right after this.
Redbox Media invites you to Bless the Yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit redboxmedia.com.
Host Mark Shea. We're here today with Steve Gradonis. If you want to join the conversation, please, by all means, do so. Give us a call. We're at 1-573-4-BREAD-4. 1-573-4-BREAD, B-R-E-A-D, 4. You can also text us at that number, or you can tweet us at Bradbox Media. You were talking before the break about getting a mention by Roger Ebert, both on the air and in his column. One of the odder phenomena that happens, I was mentioning over the break, there's that weird moment when, like, 10 years after you graduated from high school, you had Mr. Smith, your math teacher. And he, you know, he always was dressed impeccably, and he had the skinny tie, and he was all business, and he taught you your math, and he was always Mr. Smith. And then, so 10 years later, you're at the mall, and you're walking down the mall, and you bump into Mr. Smith, and you say, "Hello, Mr. Smith." And then he looks at you, and he says, "Oh, call me Bob." And you have no idea what to do. Yeah. It's like, no, I can't do that. Would be wrong. That would there's a fundamental ontological rift in the universe if something happens to change that relationship. And I remember, you know, a couple of years ago, as you mentioned during the last segment, one of the people that had a big influence on me, was very important for me, was John Michael Talbot. Listening to his music and kind of beginning to think Catholicly, and one of the, I read a biography of him called Troubadour for the Lord that was written by a mutual friend of ours, a guy named Dan O'Neill, who lives out here in Seattle. Mm-hmm. Dan is the founder of Mercy Corps and has done all this stuff. And I'd gotten to know Dan because he lived in the area. Anyway, at some point or another, you know, I crossed paths with John Michael Talbot, and he was like, "Mark," and I'm like, "I don't know how to address you because you are a remote, very important figure in my life that I don't know how to engage with in any way, you know." And so it was such a strange feeling. And I had the same, experience. Another very important figure for me coming into the church was Peter Kraft.
Uh-huh.
He teaches at Boston College. He's written 50 million books, And somewhere along the lines, we both wound up speaking at the same thing. And I'm like in the green room, and I mean, he's just, a chatty, affable guy.
Yes.
But it was like, and he's like, call me Peter. And I'm like, I don't know how to do that. Right. You're Dr. Kraft,
I just saw him last year at the graduation, the commencement exercises at Christendom College. Uh-huh. My daughter Sarah was a junior that year, and I was going there to pick her up and bring her home, but she wanted to attend the commencement because a lot of her friends were graduating, and Dr. Kraft was there, and he was the speaker. Mm-hmm. And so he and I had a nice chat. He was even more instrumental to my conversion than to yours, because he and I were pen pals going back to when I was in high school before I even knew he was a Catholic.
Well, he's the reason I know you.
That's true. Because you sent him a copy of an unpublished manuscript for
this
your
is my
first
body.
Book. This is my body.
And that's right.
He sent that manuscript on to me because I was pestering him with questions about transubstantiation.
Yeah. That's how I got to know you. We started, I just found, like, when I was doing my taxes, I've got this big box full of like old taxes stuff. And so I started thinking, the box is pretty full. So I started thinking, is there anything I can get rid of out of this box that's like not tax stuff? So I started pouring over it. Well, it turns out there was this big fat folder full of my correspondence with you from like 1991.
And I have a similar folder of that same correspondence, including photocopies of my letters to you as well as your letters to me.
That's right. I remember getting a letter from you one time where you had some dream or something, because you had no idea what I looked like, and I didn't know.
Oh,
what
yes. Like.
Yes, he had some, dream, and it was like this hilarious sort of Legolas superhero character or something. I was like, I don't look like that. Boy, do I not look like that.
I think that Atari Force. I'm just Googling Atari Force because I'm trying to remember the name of the hero in the second Atari Force comic book. I kind of dreamed that you looked like him. Tempest. Christopher Tempest Champion. This long flowing blonde hair,
yes,
and this swashbuckling headband.
So not me.
I never had long flowing swashbuckling hair, but I did have that black headband in college. I wore this very ostentatious flowing headband. it was part of my ensemble, part of my identity at the time of my life.
Well, no wonder you were drawn to drama. That is so epic. Yeah. So,
well, okay.
Anyway, all of that is to say that, it's one of the weird things for me doing this strange line of work has been that I've gotten to know a lot of the people who I was like, ooh, and it's such a strange moment, where they look at you like your math teacher and say, well, call me Bob, call me Peter. Yes. Well, it's like, I don't know what to do.
I don't remember if that's happened with me and Peter Kraft yet. I sometimes call him Peter in conversation with other people, because Dr. Kraft gets a little cumbersome eventually. But I think when I had dinner with him once with Jimmy Akin, back when my now 15-year-old son was being baptized, Jimmy was in town because he was the godfather, and we drove up to Boston, and I had dinner with Dr. Kraft, and I'm pretty sure I call him Dr. Kraft then, and I think I call him Dr. Kraft last year. Christendom, where, by the way, this year, my daughter, of course, having been a junior last year, she's graduating this year, and she is graduating salutatorian. So
fantastic.
Yes.
That's so great. Very, you know, happy. I sometimes think that the moment where in Exodus 3, where Moses says, "Who shall I say sent me?"
Mm-hmm.
And God, who has hitherto been known as, you know, things like El Shaddai and these titles.
Mm-hmm.
And he says to Moses, "Call me Yahweh." And it's that same moment of like, you do that? Is that okay? It would not be okay had not God said it. But because God says it, then it's all right. And it's that kind of qualitative change in relationship that I think Moses is sensing there. And that's it's a very strange moment. To me, one of the things that's always helped me to understand is why the Old Testament fascination with the significance of names. That moment when your math teacher says, "Call me Bob," is sort of a faint echo of that intuition that names really do matter, that they're not just labels that you stick on thingamajigs. So anyway, far afield, and yet bringing things around to life, the universe, and everything from a Catholic perspective. So that's what we do here.
Yes.
So anyway,
movies. Because I said, and we're going to do it with movies.
Yeah.
Well, that is really what I wanted to. That's really the challenge that I saw, and then that I set for myself when I first set out to do what I called at the beginning of my work in Decent Films. To offer film appreciation, information, and criticism informed by Christian faith. Mm-hmm. I wanted to approach film in a human way, mm-hmm. to watch movies the same way that everybody else watched them, but in the belief that Christianity, that Christian faith, illuminates the whole of life. It doesn't turn it into something else. It doesn't make us, you know, it doesn't turn us into angels or make us in any other way unearthly or inhuman. Rather, it completes and perfects and informs our human nature and all of the things that God created us as human beings to do. So I embarked on this work of film criticism in the conviction that film is important because in a way it's a synthesis of all the other types of arts. I mean, human beings have always created images and they've always told stories and they've always created music and there's always been dance and there's always been things like sculpture and architecture and there's always been, I don't know how always this one exactly is, but drama and acting out stories has always been a part of the human experience. Mm-hmm. And cinema really brings all of these things together in a very powerful way. And yeah, that has important implications from the perspective of Christian anthropology.
Well, we'll talk about it when we return. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today with Steve Gradonis, and we'll be back right after this.
Redbox Media invites you to Bless the Yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit redboxmedia.com.
We're talking a little bit about kind of taking a different tack today. Instead of talking about the movies too much, we're just talking a little bit about how did Steve get involved in life as a Catholic film critic. a fairly specialized line of work. And it's kind of what makes you tick, and what are you seeking to achieve in your work with film? I know that you've got a very active imagination yourself, because I've seen you noodling and toying with all kinds of different ideas and projects over the years.
Have we lost Mark?
I'm here.
Oh, okay. There was a weird connectivity issue, and I lost the last bit of what you were saying there.
Oh, okay. I was saying that I know that you've got an active imagination. You've done graphic arts in the past. You did the glow in the dark cover of my first book.
Yes, I did.
and I know how proud you are of that work. And hey, you did what I asked. I wanted a book cover that was visible across the store. It worked. It was great.
It's visible from space.
It's visible from space. And over the years, I know you've had various imaginative ideas and all kinds of irons in the fire and different things that you do. But the work of a Catholic film critic is that's an unusual place to go with your life. As is, frankly. You're graduating tomorrow from your studies, and you're about to become a deacon too. A lot of people don't know that. Soon you will be Deacon Steve Gradonis, writing film reviews. And so I guess I'm asking, could you talk about this integration of your interest in the arts and faith, and why you have an obvious burning passion to talk about it out loud in the public square, and you've done a fine job of it for years. What are you trying to achieve? What are you hoping will happen with the average reader or viewer out there?
Well, as we've been talking about, I think that my work begins with a love of movies, but also with a love of thinking and talking about movies, analyzing them, exploring them, just ruminating, debating, cross-examining, rethinking them. Now, the great thing about movies is actually watching them. That's the whole point of a movie is to watch it. But I have always found, since I was quite young, that a movie that is only watched and then not contemplated and discussed is a movie that is only half watched. It's like a meal that's been eaten but not digested. And so, in a way, film criticism is about the process of digesting, the process of assimilating, taking something in, deciding what parts of it should be discarded, and what parts of it can become a part of you. The metaphor really works. And mm-hmm. and I know that not everybody feels that way. There are lots of moviegoers who just approach movies as pure diversion. It's an amusement that lasts as long as there are pictures on the screen. And when it's over, when the credits roll, the experience is over. And there are a lot of movies that don't call for a great deal of contemplation and discussion. Mm-hmm. If you wanted to continue the digesting metaphor, you might say that some movies are more like bubblegum. You enjoy the taste while it's in your mouth, but when it's gone, you throw it away. Mm-hmm. And there's not necessarily anything wrong with that. Entertainment and amusement are important parts of life, and the popes have talked about that, going back to Pope Pius the 11th in his encyclical Vigilante Cura, which is the first papal document.
But that also would be an awesome, badass motion picture name for some kind of Chuck Norris film, I think.
Vigilante Cura. Well, vigilant, what it means in this case is with vigilant watchfulness. So, there's nothing wrong with bubblegum, but you can't live on bubblegum. And there's nothing wrong with entertainment and amusement, but God has made us for more than just recreation and diversion. And of course, ultimately, we're made for God. But God has made us humans. He's made us as creatures who are artistic and cultural and musical and dramatic and visual and temporal. And all of these things which are fulfilling to our nature are, by that very fact, glorifying to God. Mm-hmm. Everything in creation glorifies God in accordance with his nature. The sun glorifies God by shining, and plants glorify God by growing, and cheetahs glorify God by running after gazelles, and gazelles glorify God by trying to get away from the cheetahs. And we, as St. Thomas More says in one of my all-time favorite movies, A Man for All Seasons, man God has made to serve him wittily in the tangle of his mind. Includes all the kinds of things that we do, including all the cultural things, making images and looking at them, crafting music and dance, performing and enjoying music and dance, mm-hmm. coming up with stories and telling them, setting them down in words and pictures and so forth. Yeah. And the exploration and the explication of this is also a way of glorifying God. And this is something there are two disconnects here. And what I'm trying to do in my work is to bridge these two disconnects. On the one hand, you have the Christians who take, some of them who take a more disparaging view of movies, entertainment, vulgarity, frivolity, any non-obligatory activity that's not overtly religious or spiritual, even, people say. There are much better ways to spend one's time. You know, they would always rather pray another rosary or make another chapel visit than, you know, watch a John Ford movie or a Hitchcock movie. And, you know, they might rather always read the Bible or St. Louis de Montfort than pick up Mark Twain or Jane Austen. Mm-hmm. And certainly prayer is more important than movies.
Right, sure.
But God has not made us only to pray. In fact, even in religious orders, even people who have left the world behind to devote their whole lives to God are not allowed to pray all the time. They're not allowed to pray when they're meant to be playing and engaging in recreation, mm-hmm. which is a fact I actually originally first learned from a movie, from The Passion of Bernadette, which is the sequel to Jean Delannoy's Bernadette about Bernadette Silverio. Mm-hmm. And that's the religious. Now, those of us who live in the world, in the secular lay state, we have a different vocation. We're not meant to be monastic wannabes. So that's right. My one purpose. I want to show very pious Catholics and very pious Christians that you can be a good Catholic and a good Christian and care about culture, and care and get something meaningful out of the movies. Yeah. Whether it's, you know, something silly like the latest Avengers movie or something much deeper like Of Gods and Men. Mm-hmm. So then there's the other disconnect, which is the disconnect with the serious secular cinephile, the people who love movies and who see religion as being something that's opposed to, you know, having fun or serious culture. These are the people who've only experienced Christian concern with film in terms of how film can corrupt our youth and how many bad words and how much skin and how much violence, mm-hmm. and so forth. And what I want to try to show them is that a person who is serious about his faith can also be serious about film. And, you know, in my criticism, to connect with people who are atheists or agnostics, mm-hmm. or nominal Christians, and to show them that what they're interested in film is not an obstacle to faith, and in both cases, really, to kind of create a cognitive disconnect and to bridge the gap between these two worlds. Because I have one foot very firmly in one world and one foot very firmly in the other, and I have so many people who can only identify with or understand one or the other. And so I'm trying to bring these two things together, and that is actually how I wound up getting my second and my most prized mention by Roger Ebert.
Do tell.
Well, one of the first challenges I set out for myself as soon as I created Decent Films was I said, there's a movie I'm going to have to write about, and nobody's ever going to care. Nobody's ever going to read this because it's, you know, more than 10 years old. And I needed to write an essay about The Last Temptation of Christ. And that meant I had to watch it. And that was really difficult. Watching that movie is one of the hardest things I ever had to do. And what I wanted to do was write an essay that would show people, like Roger Ebert, who said that the movie wasn't blasphemous, why people on the other side said that it was blasphemous without coming off like a fundamentalist.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote that essay, and it turned out to be one of the most popular things that I've ever written. It's always very high up in my monthly stats as to things that people are reading, much to my amazement. I wrote it for myself. I didn't write it for anybody else. But it's,
okay.
Roger Ebert, in his essay on The Last Temptation of Christ, for his book on Martin Scorsese, said, "The movie is indeed technically blasphemous. I have been persuaded by this by Stephen DeGradonis."
Hey!
The critic who writes for the National Academy. And he talked about how I had changed his mind about the subject, and that just blew me away.
Fantastic. We will continue this right after this break. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here with Stephen Gradonis, world famous film critic, and we'll be back right after this.
Redbox Media invites you to Bless the Yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit redboxmedia.com.
And welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today with Steve Gradonis. If you want to join the conversation, give us a call. We're at 1-573-4-BREAD-4, 1-573-4-BREAD-4. And you can also tweet us at Breadbox Media. Yeah, I mean, gee whiz, that's no mean feat, persuading Roger Ebert to see The Last Temptation of Christ as you did.
What was really surreal about that experience was that I quoted Ebert in the piece. Not anything that he had said about Last Temptation, but I was trying to make an argument about an image late in the film that's commonly been called a dream sequence or a vision sequence, whatever. It's where Jesus actually does come down from the cross and walk away and marry Mary Magdalene and have a normal life and grow old. And then he's almost dying. And then at the very end, he realizes he has to go back and die on the cross. And so all of that is either wiped out or it was a dream or whatever it is. He dies on the cross in the end. Mm-hmm. And just the image of the actor playing Jesus, like smooching with Mary Magdalene, just struck me as so wrong,
right?
So profoundly, just purely visually, like no narrative context could possibly justify that image in my mind. Mm-hmm. And I argued, I borrowed an argument from Roger Ebert, who had made the same argument in his review, I believe, of Spike Lee's Bamboozled regarding blackface. Ebert said that there was a point beyond which the use of blackface in a movie, the medium overwhelmed the message, and no narrative context could justify using that image or overcome the sheer repulsiveness of it. And I thought that was an interesting argument, and I don't know whether it applied to Bamboozle, but I thought it applied here. And so I quoted Ebert. And if you had told me in 2000 when I wrote that essay that within a decade Roger Ebert was going to be quoting my essay, it would have blown my mind. So this is what I'm trying to do in my work, is to bridge this gap between people of faith who are not entirely comfortable with engaging film in the way I think film should be engaged, and people who are film lovers who have questions about faith, and to show them that there really is no contradiction here. And in fact, that there can be a very important and interesting dialogue between these two worlds.
Yeah. One of the things that you mentioned earlier was the discomfort that some, not all, people of faith, I mean, there have been people of faith who have made some really impressive films. You know, you think of Terrence Malick's works, for
example. Uh-huh. Yeah.
But also, it's no big secret that quote-unquote Christian films, for whatever reason, they seem to be... A friend of mine once said that there are two ways of drawing a horse. One of them is to draw a horse. The other way is to draw a horse, and then right underneath, this is a horse! And that's an awful lot of Christian filmmaking takes the latter course. And so, you know, you have Christian films. There have been, you know, and again, I look at something like The Passion of the Christ, and I think, you know, whatever you think of Mel Gibson, that was a piece of art. It was, and it respected how film actually works.
Yes.
But you know, you get movies like God's Not Dead. Yes. You know, they're films that are made by Christians for Christians. They're ostensibly evangelistic, but really what they are films that are meant to give a particular subculture within the church a sense of unit cohesion in a world that they hate and fear. And that's not evangelism, you know? I wish that we could get Christian filmmakers who got the grammar of film and didn't see stories almost entirely in terms of propaganda vehicles,
right?
Rather than works of art,
right? And that goes to questions about what the essential nature of art is,
mm-hmm.
And movies can do more than just be art. Movies can educate, they can entertain, they can divert, they can motivate, they can stir people's emotions. They can do lots of things that are not what it is that art does for us.
Mm.
But if I had to try to express something of the essential nature of at least representative art, and I don't know that I can ever express what the mission of art as a whole is, but I think I could say with at least in a very broad way what I think the essential mission of any kind of narrative art is, whether it's painting or drawing or sculpture or drama of any kind, whether it's just you're reading a novel or you're watching a movie. I think that what art seeks to do is to help us to see the world.
Mm-hmm.
And in particular, to see that which is hidden in the world, to help us to see the world in a new way. The artist's mission is to see what we don't see and to make it visible to us.
Right.
And that means that the artist has to challenge his audience. And if the artist is going to challenge his audience, very probably he has to challenge himself. Mm-hmm. So an artist has to, and that's why we do art. And I think that's essentially what art is. Art always involves, I think, some kind of effort at self-transcendence. There's what I know, there's what I can explain, there's what I'm comfortable with, and then there's what I have to try to reach for.
Mm.
And I can explain all of the things that I know using logic and prose and narrative. But when it comes to those things that are a little beyond me, those things that I have to reach for, that's where imagination steps in to bridge the gap between where I am and what's beyond me. And that's where art comes in. So a good story should challenge its audience, and not just challenge them to do what they would have said that they ought to do before they watched the movie. It should challenge them in to enlarge their vision. You should become a larger person watching a movie that really challenges you, because you now see things that you didn't see before, or you see them in a larger way.
Right.
It leaves you something to chew on and to digest and to assimilate, and you become a different person by that process.
The word recognize, mm-hmm. Means, you know, to see something again, to understand something again. And that's always the experience that I've had of an encounter with really good art, is that you have that moment where you go, oh, I've been looking at this all my life and I never saw it before.
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly.
And now I see it. And that's what recognition is, you know, kind of when the lights go on and you go, oh, I know what I'm seeing. It's like that moment when you're driving around lost somewhere and suddenly you get reorientated and you figure out where you are.
Mm-hmm.
It's that moment. And that's what art can do for us, is it can make us see things that we've already seen before, but we were never looking. And, you know, of course, that's what revelation does for us, too. You know, when Jesus says, let him who has eyes to see, see, let him who has ears to hear, hear. That's what we're talking about. And art is invaluable for that. So it's one of the great gifts, and it requires something that I think a lot of Christians, especially Christians who are concerned about orthodoxy, are leery of, which is thinking in new ways. We tend to pit orthodoxy against the idea of the new. But in fact, of course, part of what the revelation does for us is it makes all things new.
It's always new. It's always new. And we are always discovering what we already know in new ways, because the world around us is always changing and new facets of the truth are right. always being newly revealed and newly rediscovered.
Right. And that frightens any number of Christians who are have quite about had it up to here with new things. What yes. they want is old things, you know.
And old things are good too.
And old things are good too. But it is the case, you know, that, you know, one of the things that Jesus says, the great paradox that Jesus speaks at the Last Supper, and that John repeats to us, you know, John says, beloved, I don't give you a new commandment, but a commandment you've had from the beginning. And yet, it is a new commandment. And the commandment is love one another. And that's the paradox of the faith. And the creativity of the gospel is that on the one hand, yeah, it's always saying something old. But at the same time, as new as the beginning of the world, because it comes from God who is older than the world. I want to thank you so much for being on the show today, Steve. And I look forward to talking to you again. We'll be talking either next Tuesday or next Friday. I'm not sure which. but until then, God blessing on your graduation and your becoming a deacon. Ethan Bolin has been our producer. You've been listening to Connecting the Dots.